Chapter 26. The Inn of Pont du Gard. Such of my readers as have made a pedestrian excursion to the south of France may perchance have noticed, midway between the town of Beaucaire and the village of Bellegarde, a small roadside inn, from the front of which hung, creaking and flapping in the wind, a sheet of tin covered with a caricature resemblance of the Pont du Gard. This modern place of entertainment stood on the left-hand side of the Grand Route, turning its back upon the Rhône. It also boasted of what in Languedoc is styled a garden, consisting of a small plot of ground, a full view of which might be obtained from a door immediately opposite the grand portal by which the travellers were ushered in to partake of the hospitality of mine host of the Pont du Gard. This plaisance, or garden, scorched up beneath the ardent sun of a latitude of 30 degrees, permitted nothing to thrive or scarcely live in its arid soil. A few dingy olives and stunted fig trees struggled hard for existence, but their withered, dusty foliage abundantly proved how unequal was the conflict. Between these sickly shrubs grew a scanty supply of garlic, tomatoes, and eschalots, while, lone and solitary, like a forgotten sentinel, a tall pine raised its melancholy head in one of the corners of this unattractive spot, and displayed its flexible stem and fan-shaped summit dried and cracked by the withering influence of the Mistral, that scourge of Provence. In the surrounding plain, which more resembled a dusty lake than solid ground, were scattered a few miserable stalks of wheat, the effect, no doubt, of a curious desire on the part of the agriculturalists of the country to see whether such a thing as the raising of grain in those parched regions was practicable. The scanty produce, however, served to accommodate the numerous grasshoppers who follow the unfortunate invader of this bare soil with untiring persecution, resting themselves after their chase upon the stunted specimens of horticulture, while they fill the ear with their sharp, shrill cry. For nearly the last 8 years, the small tavern we have just been describing had been kept by a man and his wife, with two servants, one a strong, sturdy wench answering to the name of Trinette, officiated in the capacity of chambermaid, while the other, a shock-headed country lad named Paco, undertook the management of the outer door work, and contented himself with the title of garçon d'écurie, or ostler, as we should style it in England. But alas, the occupation of each domestic was but nominal, for a canal recently made between Beaucaire and Aiguemorte had proved a most successful speculation, and had transferred the mode of sending merchandise and luggage from the heavy wagons to the towed barge, while travellers forsook the diligence to glide over the smooth waters by the more agreeable aid of the steamboat. And as though to add to the daily misery which this prosperous canal inflicted on the unfortunate innkeeper, whose utter ruin it was fast accomplishing, it was situated not 100 steps from the forsaken inn of which we have given so faithful a description. The innkeeper himself was a man of from 40 to 55 years of age, tall, strong, and bony, a perfect specimen of the natives of those southern latitudes. He had the dark, sparkling, and deep-set eye, curved nose, and teeth white as those of a carnivorous animal. His hair, which, spite of the light touch time had as yet left on it, seemed as though it refused to assume any other colour than its own, was like his beard, which he wore under his chin, thick and curly, and but slightly mingled with a few silvery threads. His naturally murky complexion had assumed a still further shade of brown, from the habit the unfortunate man had acquired of stationing himself from early morn till latest eve at the threshold of his door, in eager hope that some traveller, either equestrian or pedestrian, might bless his eyes, and give him the delight of once more seeing a guest enter his doors. But his patience and his expectations were alike useless. Yet there he stood, day after day, exposed to the meridional rays of a burning sun, with no other protection for his head than a red handkerchief twisted around it, after the manner of the Spanish muleteers. This anxious, careworn innkeeper was no other than our old acquaintance Caderousse. His wife, on the contrary, whose maiden name had been Madeleine Radel, was pale, meagre, and sickly-looking. Born in the neighbourhood of Arles, she had shared in the beauty for which its females are proverbial. But that beauty had gradually withered beneath the devastating influence of one of those slow fevers so prevalent in the vicinity of the waters of Aiguemorte, and the marshes of Camargue. She remained nearly always in her chamber, situated on the first floor, sitting shivering in her chair, or extended languid and feeble on her bed, while her husband kept his daily watch at the door, a duty he performed with so much the greater willingness as it saved him the necessity of listening to the endless plaints and murmurs of his helpmate, who never saw him without breaking out into bitter invectives against fate and the unmerited hardships she was called upon to endure, to all of which her husband would calmly return an unvarying reply, couched in these philosophic words.
"Cease to grieve about it, La Carconte. It is God's pleasure that you should suffer, and whether you like it or not, you must bear it."
The sobriquet of La Carconte had been bestowed on Madeleine Radel from the circumstance of her having been born in a village so called, situated between Salon and Lambèze, and as a custom existed among the inhabitants of that part of France where Caderousse lived of styling every person by some particular and distinctive appellation, her husband had bestowed on her the name of La Carconte in place of her sweet and euphonious name of Madeleine, which in all probability his rude guttural language would not have enabled him to pronounce. Still, let it not be supposed that amid this affected resignation to the will of Providence, the unfortunate innkeeper did not writhe under the double misery of seeing the hateful canal carry off alike his customers and profits, and the daily implication of his peevish partner's murmurs and lamentations. Like other dwellers of the South, he was a man of sober habits and moderate desires, but fond of external show, vain and addicted to display. During the days of his prosperity, not a fete, festivity, or ceremonial took place without himself and wife being among the spectators. He dressed in the picturesque costume worn upon grand occasions by the inhabitants of the south of France, bearing equal resemblance to the style adopted both by the Catalans and Andalusians, while La Carconte displayed the charming fashion prevalent among the females of Arles, a mode of attire borrowed equally from Greece and Arabia. But by degrees, watch-chains, necklaces, many-coloured scarfs, embroidered bodices, velvet vests, elegantly worked stockings, striped gaiters and silver buckles for the shoes, all disappeared, and Gaspard Caderousse, unable to appear abroad in his pristine splendour, had given up any further participation in these pomps and vanities, both for himself or wife, although a bitter feeling of envious discontent filled his mind at the sound of mirth and merry music from the joyous revellers reached even the miserable hostelry to which he still clung, more for the shelter than the profit it afforded. On the present day, Caderousse was, as usual, at his place of observation before the door, his eyes glancing listlessly from a piece of closely shaven grass, on which some fowls were industriously, though fruitlessly, endeavouring to turn up some grain or insect suited to their palate, to the deserted road, the two extremities of which pointed respectively north and south, when he was roused from his daily speculations as to the possibility of the tavern of the Pont du Gard ever again being called upon to exercise its hospitable capabilities to any chance visitant by the shrill voice of his wife summoning him to her presence with all speed. Murmuring at the disagreeable interruption to his not very agreeable thoughts, he, however, proceeded to the floor in which was situated the chamber of his better half, taking care, however, preparatory to so doing, to set the entrance door wide open, that, in the event of that rara avis, a traveller passing by, it should be made perfectly clear to his comprehension that no ceremony was requisite in entering. At the moment Caderousse quitted his sentry-like watch before the door, the road on which he so eagerly strained his sight was void and lonely as a desert at midday. There it lay stretched out, one interminable line of dust and sand, with its sides bordered by tall, meagre trees, altogether presenting so uninviting an appearance that no one in his senses could have imagined that any traveller, at liberty to regulate his hours for journeying, would choose to expose himself to the scorching heat of a meridian sun in such a formidable Sahara. Nevertheless, had Caderousse but retained his post a few minutes longer, he might have caught a dim outline of something approaching from the direction of Bellegarde. As the moving object drew nearer, he would easily have perceived it consisted of a man and horse, between whom the kindest and most amiable understanding appeared to exist. The horse was of Hungarian breed, and ambled along with that easy pace peculiar to that race of animals. His rider was a priest, dressed in black, and wearing a three-cornered hat, and spite of the ardent rays of a noonday sun, the pair came on at a tolerably smart trot. Having arrived before the Pont du Gard, the horse stopped, but whether for his own pleasure or that of his rider would have been difficult to say. However that might have been, the measure appeared reciprocally agreeable, since no demur was observable in either. The priest, dismounting, led his steer by the bridle in search of some place to which he could secure him. Availing himself of a handle that projected from a half-fallen door, he tied the animal safely, patted him kindly, and having drawn a red cotton handkerchief from his pocket, wiped away the perspiration that streamed from his brow. Then, advancing to the door, struck thrice with the end of his iron-shod stick. At this unusual sound, a huge black dog came rushing to meet the daring assailant of his ordinarily tranquil abode, snarling and displaying his sharp white teeth with a determined hostility that abundantly proved how little he was accustomed to society. At that moment, a heavy footstep was heard descending the wooden staircase that led from the upper floor, and with many bows and courteous smiles, mine host of the Pont du Gard welcomed the blessing heaven had sent him in the shape of a weary traveller. While retreating into the house with backward step, he besought his guest would honour him by entering also.
"You are welcome, sir, most welcome," repeated the astonished Caderousse in his blandest tones. "Now then, Margontin," cried he, speaking to the dog, "will you be quiet? Pray don't heed him, sir. He only barks, he never bites. I make no doubt a glass of good wine would be acceptable this dreadfully hot day."
Then, perceiving for the first time the description of traveller he had to entertain, Caderousse hastily exclaimed,
"A thousand pardons, your reverence! I really did not observe whom I had the honour to receive under my poor roof. What would you please to have, Monsieur l'Abbé? What refreshment can I offer you? All I have is at your service."
The priest gazed on the individual addressing him with a long and searching gaze. There even seemed like a disposition on his part to court a similar scrutiny on the part of the innkeeper. Then, remarking in the countenance of the latter no other expression than extreme surprise at his own want of attention to an inquiry so courteously worded, he deemed it as well to terminate this dumb show, and therefore said, speaking with a strong Italian accent,
"You are, I presume, Monsieur Caderousse?" "Your reverence is quite correct," answered the host, even more surprised at the question than he had been by the silence which had prefaced it. "I am Gaspard Caderousse, at your service."
"Gaspard Caderousse," rejoined the priest.
"Yes, that agrees both with the baptismal appellation and surname of the individual I allude to. You formerly lived, I believe, in the Allée de Meillan, on the fourth floor of a small house situated there?"
"I did."
"Where you followed the business of a tailor?"
"True, I was a tailor, till the trade fell off so as not to afford me a living. Then it was so very hot at Marseille that really I could bear it no longer. And it is my idea that all the respectable inhabitants will be obliged to follow my example and quit it. But talking of heat, is there nothing I can offer you by way of refreshment?"
"Yes, let me have a bottle of your best wine, and then, with your permission, we will resume our conversation from where we left off."
"As you please, Monsieur l'Abbé," said Caderousse, who, anxious not to lose the present opportunity of finding a customer for one of the few bottles of vin de Cahors still remaining in his possession, hastily raised a trap-door in the floor of the apartment they were in, which served both as parlour and kitchen.
Upon his issuing forth from his subterranean retreat at the expiration of 5 minutes, he found the abbé seated on a species of stool, leaning his elbow on a table, while Margontin, whose animosity seemed appeased by the traveller having pronounced the unusual command for refreshments, had crept up to him and had established himself very comfortably between his knees, his long skinny neck resting on his lap, while his dim eye was fixed earnestly on the traveller's face.
"Are you quite alone?"
inquired the guest, as Caderousse placed before him the bottle of wine and a glass.
Quite alone," replied the man. "Or at least all but so, Monsieur l'Abbé, for my poor wife, who is the only person in the house besides myself, is laid up with illness, and unable to render me the least assistance, poor thing."
"You are married, then?"
said the priest, with a species of interest, glancing round as he spoke at the scanty style of accommodations and humble fittings-up of the apartment.
"Ah, Monsieur l'Abbé," said Caderousse with a sigh, "it is easy to perceive I am not a rich man, but in this world a man does not thrive the better for being honest."
The Abbé fixed on him a searching, penetrating glance.
"I can certainly say that much for myself," repeated the innkeeper, fairly sustaining the scrutiny of the Abbé's gaze. "I can boast with truth of being an honest man, and," continued he significantly, shaking his head, "that is more than every one can say nowadays."
"So much the better for you, if what you assert be true," said the Abbé, "for I am firmly persuaded that sooner or later the good will be rewarded and the wicked punished."
"Such words as those belong to your profession, Monsieur l'Abbé," answered Caderousse, "and you do well to repeat them, but," added he with a bitter expression of countenance, "you cannot make people believe them in opposition to what passes before them every day, when the reverse takes place, and it is the wicked man who prospers and the honest, deserving man who suffers."
"You are wrong to speak thus," said the Abbé, "and perhaps I may, in my own person, be able to prove to you how completely you are in error in coming to so mischievous and dangerous a conclusion."
"What mean you?" inquired Caderousse, with a look of surprise.
"In the first place it is requisite I should be satisfied you are the person I am in search of."
"What proofs do you require?"
"Did you, in the year 1814 or 1815, know anything of a young sailor named Edmond Dantès?"
"Did I? I should think I did.
Poor dear Edmond!
Why, Edmond Dantès and myself were intimate friends!"
exclaimed Caderousse, whose countenance assumed an almost purple hue as he caught the penetrating gaze of the Abbé fixed on him, while the clear, calm eye of the questioner seemed to cover him with confusion.
"You remind me," said the priest, "that the young man concerning whom I asked you was said to bear the name of Edmund."
"Said to bear the name?" repeated Caderousse, becoming excited and eager. "Why, he was so called as truly as I myself bore the appellation of Gaspar Caderousse. But, Monsieur l'Abbé, tell me, I pray, what has become of poor Edmund? Did you know him? Is he alive and at liberty? Is he prosperous and happy?"
"He died a more wretched, hopeless, heartbroken prisoner than the felons who pay the penalty of their crimes at the galleys of Toulon."
A deadly paleness succeeded the deep suffusion which had before spread itself over the countenance of Caderousse, who turned away, but not so much, so as to prevent the priest's observing him, wiping away the tears from his eyes with a corner of the red handkerchief twisted round his head.
"Poor fellow! Poor fellow!" murmured Caderousse. "Well, there, Monsieur l'Abbé, is another proof that good people are never rewarded on this earth, and that none but the wicked prosper." "Ah!" continued Caderousse, speaking in the highly coloured language of the South, "the world grows worse and worse. Why does not God, if he really hates the wicked, as he is said to do, send down brimstone and fire and consume them altogether?"
"You speak as though you had loved this young Dantès," observed the Abbé, without taking any notice of his companion's vehemence.
"And so I did," replied Caderousse, "though once I confess I envied him his good fortune. But I swear to you, Monsieur l'Abbé, I swear to you by everything a man holds dear, I have since then deeply and sincerely lamented his unhappy fate."
There was a brief silence, during which the fixed, searching eye of the Abbé was employed in scrutinising the agitated features of the innkeeper.
"You knew the poor lad, then?" continued Caderousse.
"Nay, I was merely called to see him, when on his dying bed, that I might administer to him the consolations of religion."
"And of what did he die?"
asked Caderousse, in a choking voice.
"Of what, think you, do young and strong men die in prison, when they have scarcely numbered their 30th year? Unless it be of the horrors of that prison which has spread its stony walls against their breathing the air of heaven, or participating in the secret affections a gracious Creator permitted to find growth within the human breast. Edmond Dantès died in prison of sorrow and a broken heart."
Caderousse wiped away the large drops of perspiration that gathered on his brow. "But the strangest part of the story is," resumed the abbé, "that Dantès, even in his dying moments, swore by his crucified Redeemer that he was utterly ignorant of the cause of his imprisonment." "And so he was," murmured Caderousse. "How should he have been otherwise? Ah, Monsieur l'Abbé, the poor fellow told you the truth. And for that reason he besought me to try and clear up a mystery he had never been able to penetrate, and to clear his memory should any foul spot or stain have fallen on it." And here the look of the abbé, becoming more and more fixed, seemed to rest with ill-concealed satisfaction on the gloomy depression which seemed rapidly spreading over the countenance of Caderousse. "A rich Englishman," continued the abbé, "who had been his companion in misfortune, but had been released from prison during the Second Restoration, was possessed of a diamond of immense value. This precious jewel he bestowed on Dantès upon himself quitting the prison, as a mark of his gratitude for the kindness and brotherly care with which Dantès had nursed him in a severe illness he underwent during his confinement. Instead of employing this diamond in attempting to bribe his jailers, who might only have taken it and then betrayed him to the governor, Dantès carefully preserved it, that in the event of his getting out of prison he might have wherewithal to live, for the produce of such a diamond would have quite sufficed to make his fortune." "Then I suppose," asked Caderousse, with eager, glowing looks, "that it was a stone of immense value?"
"Why, everything is relative," answered the abbé. "To one in Edmund's position the diamond certainly was of great value. It was estimated at 50,000 francs.
"Bless me!" exclaimed Caderousse. "What a sum! 50,000 francs! Surely the diamond was as large as a nut to be worth all that?"
"No," replied the abbé, "it was not of such a size as that. But you shall judge for yourself. I have it with me."
The sharp gaze of Caderousse was instantly directed towards the priest's garments, as though hoping to discover the talked-of treasure. Calmly drawing forth from his pocket a small box covered with black shagreen, the abbé opened it, and displayed to the delighted eyes of Caderousse the sparkling jewel it contained, set in a ring of admirable workmanship.
"And that diamond," cried Caderousse, almost breathless with eager admiration, "you say is worth 50,000 francs?"
"It is, without the setting, which is also valuable," replied the abbé, as he closed the box and returned it to his pocket, while its brilliant hues seemed still to dance before the eyes of the fascinated innkeeper.
"But how comes this diamond in your position, Monsieur l'Abbé? Did Edmund make you his heir?"
"No, merely his testamentary executor. When dying, the unfortunate youth said to me, 'I once possessed 4 dear and faithful friends, besides the maiden to whom I was betrothed, and I feel convinced they have all unfeignedly grieved over my loss. The name of one of the 4 friends I allude to is Caderousse.'"
The innkeeper shivered as though he felt the dead, cold hand of the betrayed Edmund grasping his own.
"Another of the number," continued the abbé, without seeming to notice the emotion of Caderousse, "is called Danglars. And the 3rd, spite of being my rival, entertained a very sincere affection for me."
A fiendish smile played over the features of Caderousse, who was about to break in upon the abbé's speech, when the latter, waving his hand, said,
"Allow me to finish first, and then if you have any observations to make you can do so afterwards. The 3rd of my friends, although my rival, was much attached to me. His name was Fernand. That of my betrothed was—" "Stay, stay," continued the abbé. "I have forgotten what he called her."
"Mercedes!"
cried Caderousse eagerly.
"True," said the abbé, with a stifled sigh. "Mercedes it was."
"Go on,"
urged Caderousse.
"Bring me a carafe of water," said the abbé.
Caderousse quickly performed the stranger's bidding, and after pouring some into a glass and slowly swallowing its contents, the abbé, resuming his usual placidity of manner, said, as he placed his empty glass on the table,
"Where did we leave off?"
"Oh, that the betrothed of Edmund was called Mercedes."
To be sure. Well, then, said Dantès, for you understand I repeat his words just as he uttered them, you will go to Marseille. Do you understand?
Perfectly.
For the purpose of selling this diamond, the produce of which you will divide into 5 equal parts and give an equal portion to the only persons who have loved me upon earth.
But why into 5 parts? Asked Caderousse. You only mentioned 4 persons.
Because the 5th is dead, as I hear. The 5th sharer in Edmund's bequest was his own father.
Too true. Too true! Ejaculated Caderousse, almost suffocated by the contending passions which assailed him. The poor old man did die.
I learned so much at Marseille, replied the abbé, making a strong effort to appear indifferent. But from the length of time that has elapsed since the death of the elder Dantès, I was unable to obtain any particulars of his end. You possibly may be capable of furnishing me with such minute circumstances as may serve to substantiate the decease of the elder Dantès.
I do not know who could if I could not, said Caderousse. Why, I lived almost on the same floor with the poor old man. Ah, yes, about a year after the disappearance of his son, the old man died.
Of what did he die?
Why, the doctors called his complaint an internal inflammation, I believe. His acquaintances said he died of grief, but I, who saw him in his dying moments, I say he died of...
Of what? Asked the priest, anxiously and eagerly.
Why, of downright starvation.
Starvation? Exclaimed the abbé, springing from his seat.
Why, the vilest animals are not suffered to die by such a death as that. The very dogs that wander houseless and homeless in the streets find some pitying hand to cast them a mouthful of bread, and that a man, a Christian, should be allowed to perish of hunger in the midst of other men equally Christian with himself is too horrible for belief. Oh, it is impossible, utterly impossible.
What I have said, answered Caderousse.
And you are a fool for having said anything about it, said a voice from the top of the stairs. Why should you meddle with what does not concern you?
The 2 male speakers turned round quickly and perceived the sickly countenance of La Carconte leaning over the rail of the staircase. Attracted by the sound of voices, she had feebly dragged herself down the stairs, and, seated on the lower step, she had listened to the foregoing conversation.
"Mind your own business, wife," replied Caderousse sharply. "This gentleman asked me for information, which common politeness will not permit me to refuse."
"Politeness, you simpleton!" retorted La Carconte. What have you to do with politeness, I should like to know? Better study a little common prudence. How do you know the motives that person may have for trying to extract all he can from you?
I pledge you my sacred word, madame, said the abbé, that my intentions are free from all thoughts of harm or injury to you or yours, and that your husband can incur no risk, provided he answers me candidly.
Ah, that's all very fine, retorted the woman. Nothing is easier than to begin with fair promises and assurances of nothing to fear. But when poor silly folks like my husband there have been persuaded to tell all they know, the promises and assurances of safety are quickly forgotten. And at some moment when nobody is expecting it, behold, trouble and misery, and all sorts of persecutions, are heaped on the unfortunate wretches who cannot even see whence all their afflictions come.
Nay, nay, my good woman, make yourself perfectly easy, I beg of you. Whatever evils may befall you, they will not be occasioned by my instrumentality, that I solemnly promise you.
Some inarticulate sounds escaped La Carconte, then letting her head, which she had raised during the excitement of conversation, again droop onto her lap, she commenced her usual anguished trembling, the result of her feverish attack, leaving the 2 speakers to resume the conversation, but still remaining herself so placed as to be able to hear every word they uttered. Again the abbé had been obliged to swallow a draught of water to calm the emotions that threatened to overpower him. When he had sufficiently recovered himself, he said,
"It appears, then, that the miserable old man you were telling me of was forsaken by everyone. Surely, had not such been the case, he would not have perished by so dreadful a death as you described."
"Why, he was not altogether forsaken," continued Caderousse, "for Mercedes, the Catalan, and Monsieur Morel were very kind to him. But somehow the poor old man had contracted a profound hatred of Fernand. The very person," added Caderousse, with a bitter smile, "that you named just now as being one of Dante's faithful and attached friends."
"And was he not so?" asked the abbé.
"'Gaspar, Gaspar,' murmured the woman from her seat on the stairs. "'Mind what you're saying?'
Caderousse made no reply to these words, though evidently irritated and annoyed by the interruption, but, addressing the abbé, said,
"'Can a man be faithful to another whose wife he covets and desires for himself?' But Dantès was so honourable and true in his own nature that he believed everybody's professions of friendship. Poor Edmund. He was cruelly deceived. But it was a happy thing he never knew it, or he might have found it more difficult when on his deathbed to pardon his enemies. And whatever people may say, continued Caderousse in his native language, which was not altogether devoid of rude poetry, I cannot help being more frightened at the idea of the malediction of the dead than the hatred of the living.
"'Weak-minded coward!' exclaimed La Carconte.
"'Do you then know in what manner Fernand injured Dantès?' inquired the abbé of Caderousse.
"'Do I? No one better!'
"'Speak out, then. Say what it was.'
"'Gaspar!' cried La Carconte. "'I cannot force you to do otherwise than as you please, but if you are guided by me you will have nothing to say on this subject.'
"'Well, well, wife,' replied Caderousse, "'I do not know but what you are right. I shall follow your advice.'
"'Then you are determined not to reveal the circumstances you alluded to?' said the abbé.
"'Why, what good would it do?' asked Caderousse.
"'If the poor lad were living and came to me to beg, I would candidly tell which were his true and which his false friends. Why, perhaps I should not hesitate. But you tell me he is no more, and therefore can have nothing to do with hatred or revenge, so let all such feelings be buried with him.'
"'You prefer, then,' said the abbé, "'allowing me to bestow on men you say are false and treacherous "'the reward intended for faithful friendship.'
"'That is true enough,' returned Caderousse. "'You say truly the gift of poor Edmund was not meant "'for such traitors as Fernand and Danglars. "'Besides, what would it be to them? "'No more than a drop of water in the ocean.'
"'And remember, husband,' chimed in La Carconte, "'that to breathe one syllable against those two individuals "'will be to raise up against yourself two formidable enemies "'who at a word could level you with the dust.'
"'How so?' inquired the abbé. "'Are these persons, then, so rich and powerful?'
"'Do you not know their history?'
"'I do not. Pray, relate it to me.'
Caderousse seemed to reflect for a few moments, then said,
"'No, truly, it would take up too much time.'
"'Well, my good friend,' returned the abbé, "'in a tone that indicated utter indifference on his part.' You are at liberty either to speak or be silent, just as you please. For my own part, I respect your scruples and admire your sentiments, so let the matter end. I shall do my duty as conscientiously as I can, and fulfil my promise to the dying man. My first business will be to dispose of this diamond.
So saying, the abbé again drew the small box from his pocket, opened it, and contrived to hold it in such a light that a bright flash of brilliant hues passed before the dazzled gaze of Caderousse.
"'Wife! Wife!' cried he, in a voice almost hoarse with eager emotion. "'Come hither, and behold this rich diamond!'
"'Diamond!' exclaimed La Carconte, rising and descending to the chamber with a tolerably firm step. "'What diamond are you talking about?'
"'Why, did you not hear all we said?' inquired Caderousse. "'It is a beautiful diamond left by poor Edmund Dantès, "'to be sold and the money divided among his father, "'Mercedes, his betrothed bride, Fernand, Danglars, and myself. "'The jewel is worth at least 50,000 francs.'
"'Oh, what a splendid diamond!' cried the astonished woman.
"'The fifth part of the produce of this stone belongs to us, then, does it not?'
asked Caderousse, still devouring the glittering gem with his eyes.
"'It does,' replied the abbé, "'with the addition of an equal division of that part intended for the elder Dantès, "'which I conceive myself at liberty to share equally with the four surviving persons.'
"'And wherefore among us four?'
inquired Caderousse.
"'As being the friends Edmund esteemed most faithful and devoted.'
"'I don't call those friends who betray and ruin you,'
muttered the wife in her turn, in a low, muttering voice.
"'Of course not,' rejoined Caderousse quickly. "'No more do I.' And that was what I was observing to this gentleman just now. I said I looked upon it as a sacrilegious profanation to reward treachery, perhaps crime.
Remember, answered the abbé calmly, as he replaced the jewel and its case in the pocket of his cassock. It is your fault, not mine, that I do so. You will have the goodness to furnish me with the address of both Fernand and Danglars, in order that I may execute Edmund's last wishes.
The agitation of Caderousse became extreme, and large drops of perspiration rolled from his heated brows. As he saw the abbé rise from his seat and go towards the door, as though to ascertain if his horse were sufficiently refreshed to continue his journey, Caderousse and his wife exchanged looks of deep meaning with each other.
"There you see, wife," said the former. "This splendid diamond might be all ours if we chose."
"Do you believe it?"
"Why, surely a man of his holy profession would not deceive us."
"Well," replied La Carconte, "do as you like. For my part, I wash my hands of the affair."
So saying, she once more climbed the staircase leading to her chamber, her frame shuddering with anguish chills, and her teeth rattling in her head, spite of the intense heat of the weather. Arrived at the top stair, she turned round and called out in a warning tone to her husband,
"Gaspar, consider well what you are about to do."
"I have both reflected and decided," answered he.
La Carconte then entered her chamber, the flooring of which creaked beneath her heavy, uncertain tread, as she proceeded towards her armchair, into which she fell as though exhausted.
"Well," asked the abbé, as he returned to the apartment below, "what have you made up your mind to do?"
"To tell you all I know," was the reply.
"I certainly think you act wisely in doing so," said the priest. "Not because I have the least desire to learn anything you may desire to conceal from me, but simply that if, through your assistance, I could distribute the legacy according to the wishes of the testator, why, so much the better. That is all."
"I trust, indeed, such will be the case, and poor Edmund's dying bequest will be given only to such as you shall be convinced are his faithful and attached friends," replied Caderousse, his eyes sparkling and his face flushed with the hope of obtaining all himself.
"Now then, begin, if you please," said the abbé. "I am all attention."
"Stop a minute," answered Caderousse. "We might be interrupted in the most interesting part of my recital, which would be a pity, and it is as well that your visit hither should be made known only to ourselves."
With these words he went stealthily to the door, which he closed, and by way of still greater precaution bolted and barred it, as he was accustomed to do at night. During this time the abbé had chosen his place for listening to the painful recital he expected Caderousse's would provide. He removed his seat into a corner of the room, where he himself would be in deep shadow, while the light would be fully thrown on the narrator. Then, with head bent down and hands clasped, or rather clenched, together, he prepared to give his whole attention to Caderousse, who seated himself on the little stool exactly opposite to him.
"Remember, I did not urge you to this,"
said the trembling voice of La Carconte, as though through the flooring of her chamber she viewed the scene that was enacting below.
"Enough, enough," replied Caderousse. "Say no more about it. I will take all the consequences upon myself."
He then commenced as follows.